With the captain dead, I lost no time in telling my mother all I knew, and we found ourselves at once in a difficult and dangerous position. The Black Spot had told the captain that he had until 10 o'clock that night. Something must speedily be resolved upon. And it occurred to us at last to go forth and seek help in the neighboring hamlet. Bareheaded as we ran out at once in the gathering evening and the frosty fog. It was already candlelight when we reached the hamlet, and I shall never forget how much I was cheered to see the yellow shine in doors and windows. But that, as it proved, was to be the extent of the help we were likely to get in that quarter. The name of Captain Flint, though it was strange to me, was well enough known, and carried a great weight of terror. For that matter, anyone who was a comrade of the captain's was enough to frighten them to death. And the short and the long of the matter was that not one would help us defend the inn. When each had had his say, my mother declared that she would not lose money which belonged to a fatherless boy, and back we would go the way we had come. Of course, I said I would go with her, but even then not a man would go along with us. All they would do was to give me a loaded pistol, while one lad was to ride forward to Dr. Livesey's in search of armed assistance. My heart was beating finely when we set forth in the cold night. We slipped along the hedges, noiseless and swift, till, to our relief, we reached the inn and closed the door behind us. "Draw down the blind, Jim," whispered my mother. "Now, we have to get the key to that chest off the captain." I went down on my knees at once, and overcoming a strong repugnance, I tore open his shirt at the neck, and there, sure enough, hanging to a piece of tarry string, which I cut, we found the key. At this triumph, we hurried upstairs to the little room where his box had stood since the day of his arrival. Though the lock was very stiff, my mother had turned it and thrown back the lid in an inkling. A strong smell of tobacco and tar rose from the interior, but nothing was to be seen on top except a suit of clothes and a miscellany of trinkets of little value. Underneath was an old boat cloak, whitened with sea salt. My mother pulled it up with impatience, and there lay before us the last things in the chest, a packet tied up in oilcloth, and a canvas bag that gave forth at a touch the jingle of gold. "I'll show these rogues that I'm an honest woman," said my mother. "I'll have my dues, and not a farthing over." Counting the coins was a long, difficult business, for the coins were of all countries and sizes. When we were about halfway through, I suddenly put my hand on her arm, for I heard in the silent, frosty air a sound that brought my heart into my mouth, the tap, tap, tapping of the blind man's stick down the frozen road. "Mother," said I, "take the hole and let's be going." But my mother, frightened as she was, would not consent to take a fraction more than was due to her. She was still arguing with me when a low little whistle sounded a good way off upon the hill. "I'll take what I have," she said, jumping to her feet. "And I'll take this to square the account," said I, picking up the oilskin packet. We had started not a moment too soon, for the sound of several footsteps running came already to our ears, and as we looked back, a light tossed to and fro showed that one of the newcomers carried a lantern. "My dear," said my mother suddenly, "take the money and run on. I'm going to faint." By good fortune, we were just at the little bridge, and I helped her to the edge of the bank, where she gave a sigh and fell on my shoulder. I do not know how it was done, but I managed to drag her down the bank and a little way under the arch. There we had to stay, within earshot of the inn. My curiosity, in a sense, was stronger than my fear, for I crept back to the bank again, whence, sheltering my head behind a bush of broom, I might command the road before our door. I was scarcely in position when my enemies began to arrive, 7 or 8 of them, and a rush was made upon the Admiral Benbow. I made out, even through the mist, the figure of the blind beggar. There was a pause, then a cry of surprise, and then a voice shouting from the house that Bill was dead. I could hear their feet rattling up our old stairs so that the house must have shook with it. Promptly afterwards, fresh voices of astonishment arose.
"Phew, they've been here before us. Someone's turned the chest out alone aloft. Bill's been overhauled already. Nothing's left. It's these people at the inn. It's that boy. I wish I had put his eyes out," cried the blind man, Pew. "Scatter, lads, and find them."
Then there followed a great to-do through all our old inn, and the men came out again, one after another, and declared that we were nowhere to be found. And just then, the same whistle that had alarmed my mother and myself was once more clearly audible through the night, but this time twice repeated. From its effect on the buccaneers, it was a signal warning them of approaching danger.
"Scatter and look for them dogs! Oh, shiver my soul, if I had eyes!" cried Pew. "If you had the pluck of a weevil in a biscuit, you would catch them still!"
Pew's anger rose so high, he struck at them right and left in his blindness, and his stick sounded heavily on more than one. This quarrel was the saving of us, for while it was still raging, another sound came from the top of the hill. A pistol shot, flash and report, and just then four or five riders came in sight in the moonlight and swept at full gallop down the slope. The buccaneers turned at once and ran, separating in every direction, but Pew they had deserted. There he remained behind, tapping up and down the road in a frenzy, now utterly bewildered, right under the nearest of the oncoming horses. Down went Pew with a cry that rang high into the night, and moved no more. I leapt to my feet and hailed the riders, and I soon saw what they were. Supervisor Dance and his revenue officers, whom the lads sent from the hamlet to Dr. Livesey's, had met on the way. I went back with them to the Admiral Bembo, and you cannot imagine a house in such a state of smash. I could see at once that we were ruined. Mr. Dance could make nothing of the scene.
"Well, Hawkins, what in fortune were they after?"
"I believe I have the thing in my breast pocket, sir, and to tell you the truth, I should like to get it put in safety. I thought, perhaps, Dr. Livesey?"
"Perfectly right," said Mr. Dance. "Now, I'll tell you, Hawkins, if you like, I'll take you along."
I thanked him heartily for the offer, and we walked back to the hamlet where the horses were. As soon as I was mounted, the party struck out at a bouncing trot to Dr. Livesey's house. We rode hard all the way, till we drew up before Dr. Livesey's door. The house was all dark to the front. Mr. Dance told me to jump down and knock. The door was opened almost at once by the maid, who said that Dr. Livesey had gone to the hall to dine and pass the evening with the squire. This time the distance was short. Here Mr. Dance dismounted, and taking me along with him, was admitted at a word into the house. The servant showed us into a great library where Squire Trelawney and Dr. Livesey sat, pipe in hand, on either side of a bright fire.
"Good evening, Dance," said the doctor. "What good wind brings you here?"
The supervisor stood up straight and stiff and told his story like a lesson. And you should have seen how the two gentlemen leaned forward and looked at each other and forgot to smoke in their surprise and interest.
"So, Jim," said the doctor, when Mr. Dance had finished the story, "you have that thing they were after?"
"Here it is, sir," said I, and gave him the oilskin packet. He looked it all over, as if his fingers were itching to open it, but instead of doing that, he put it quietly in the pocket of his coat.
"Squire," said he, "when Dancer's had some ale, he must, of course, be off on His Majesty's service, but I mean to keep Jim Hawkins here and let him sup."
And so I made a hearty supper, for I was as hungry as a hawk, while Mr. Dance was further complimented and at last dismissed.
"And now, Squire," said the doctor, "you have heard of Captain Flint?"
"Heard of him?" cried the squire. "He was the bloodthirstiest buccaneer that sailed. The Spanish were so prodigiously afraid of him that, I tell you, sir, I was sometimes proud he was an Englishman."
"The point is, had he money?" asked the doctor.
"Money?" cried the squire again. "Have you heard the story? What were these villains after but money?"
"That we shall soon know," replied the doctor. "Supposing that I have in my pocket some clue to where Flint buried his treasure, will that treasure amount to much?"
"Amount, sir," cried the squire. "It will amount to this. I fit out a ship in Bristol Dock and take you and Hawkins here along, and I'll have that treasure if I search a year."
"Very well," said the doctor. "Now then, if Jim is agreeable, we'll open the packet."
The bundle was sewn together, and the doctor had to get out his instrument case and cut the stitches with his surgical scissors. It contained two things, a book and sealed paper. The doctor opened the book first. On the first page, there were only some scraps of writing, such as a man with a pen in his hand might make for idleness or practice. The next 10 pages were filled with a curious series of entries. There was a date at one end of the line, and at the other a sum of money, as in common account books. But instead of explanatory writing, only a varying number of crosses between the two.
"The thing is as clear as noonday," cried the squire. "This is the Black-Hearted Hound's account book. These crosses stand for the names of ships or towns they sank or plundered. And now for the other."
The paper had been sealed in several places with a thimble by way of seal. The doctor opened these with great care, and there fell out a map of an island, with every particular that would be needed to bring a ship to safe anchorage upon its shores. It was about 9 miles long and 5 across, and had 2 fine landlocked harbours and a hill in the centre, marked the Spyglass. There were several editions of a later date, but above all, 3 crosses of red ink, 2 on the north part of the island, 1 in the southwest, and beside this last, in the same red ink, these words: "Bulk of treasure here." Over on the back, the same hand had written, "The bar silver is in the north cache. The arms are easy found in the sandhill." That was all. But brief as it was, and to me incomprehensible, it filled the squire and Dr. Livesey with delight.
"Livesey," said the squire, "tomorrow I start for Bristol. In 10 days we'll have the best ship, sir, and the choicest crew in England. Hawkins shall come as cabin boy. You'll make a famous cabin boy, Hawkins. You, Livesey, are ship's doctor. I am admiral. We'll take Redruth, Joyce, and Hunter. We'll have favourable winds, a quick passage, and not the least difficulty in finding the spot."
"Trelawney," said the doctor, "I'll go with you. So will Jim, and be a credit to the undertaking. There's only one man I'm afraid of."
"And who's that?" cried the squire. "Name the dog, sir."
"You," replied the doctor, "for you cannot hold your tongue. We are not the only men who know of this paper. We must none of us go alone until we get to sea. You'll take Joyce and Hunter when you go to Bristol. From first to last, none of us must breathe a word of what we've found."
"Livesey," returned the squire, "you are always in the right of it. I'll be as silent as the grave."